Unbalanced Breakfast with Matt and Catherine, a.k.a. Smart.
Hamburger, the cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast.
My boy says he can eat 50 eggs, he can eat 50 eggs.
Do you like apples?
I don't drink juice. See ya!
How about you, Sad Burns? You want some of this milk?
Bless his highly nutritious microwaveable macaroni and cheese dinner that people sold it on sale. Amen.
They've got the hottest takes on the hottest stories and trends in food, nutrition, and fitness.
Come on! Bread makes you fat.
Bread makes you fat?
I haven't had a carb since 2004.
Calories, that's a gluten. Fat, that's a gluten.
Yeah, it's got electrolytes.
Filled protein combined with synthetic aminos, vitamins, and minerals. Everything the body needs.
I'm only eating foods with less than 30% calories from fat. It's 40%.
He read the squirrels were high in cholesterol.
We're about to find out what happens when a policy student and a science student interact.
And I also brought you some hydroponically grown goji berries with vegan barbecue sauce and some organic pumpkin chips.
Short answer, being vegan just makes you better than most people.
I happen to be a vegetarian.
You must have had vegetables fresher than that growing up on a farm, Greg.
Never trust a vegetarian.
Looks like meat back on our menu.
The views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of WMFO, Tufts University, or the Friedman School of Nutrition.
Yes. Who's hungry?
And the people did feast upon the lambs and sloths and carp and anchovies and orangutans and breakfast cereals and fruit bats.
Good morning and welcome to an Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO and Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
We are back for our, our fourth show. Very exciting.
Yes.
We made it this far. And we still have some firsts. So we have a couple big firsts this week. We have a correction I think we'll be announcing.
Yes.
First one of those.
Clarification.
And, we also have our first ever live in studio guest.
Yeah.
Curtis, good morning.
Hi, Curtis.
Good morning, guys. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on. Nice and early on a Saturday morning.
Yeah. Isn't it fun?
Yeah, wonderful.
Not painful at all?
No.
All right, so yeah, we're going to be talking with about a bunch of stuff with Curtis, including the Tufts Student Showcase, along with some other topics, and he'll be in here at least most of the morning, if not the whole show, maybe. So we'll have a third voice for the week. And if you want to join in, the number here is 617-627-3800. You can also chime in on Twitter at Boxman37 or Nutrition Wonk.
Yeah.
So, and we have some more music this week. Catherine is back with another song.
Yes, I got to pick another song, and it is not Vegetables by the Beach Boys yet again.
Yeah, much better choice. And another brand new Deftone song, which I'm excited about. If you can tell, I like that band. So let's start out with the clarification before we jump in.
Okay, so the first 2 weeks that we did the show, you might remember them because this is only the fourth week, but we were talking a little bit about coffee. So the first week we kind of talked about it had been in the Well blog, and someone had been asking, I'm not a coffee drinker, should I start drinking coffee? And then the next week we talked about some research that had come out talking about how coffee could potentially prevent or somehow have a negative or have a sort of ameliorating effect on liver cirrhosis, I believe. And so at some point, some comment may have been thrown about that said something like, coffee isn't a medication. So at Skeptic Petty, thank you, Clay, has sent us a quick clarification just to make sure that everybody is clear that just because coffee isn't a medication doesn't mean the caffeine isn't a drug. So I think he kind of wanted to just clarify that if we implied that coffee's not a medication, it's not a drug, it's not a controlled substance, that means you can just have as much as you want and it's good for you because it's quote-unquote natural. You know, that's a logical fallacy. Just because something is natural, occurs naturally, or is, you know, culturally very prevalent, doesn't mean that it's always safe. But then, of course, coffee is usually safe. And then, you know, you always have things like high school athletes or kids staying up all night and drinking Four Loko. Those are illegal now. But like, and, you know, overdosing on caffeine. So definitely don't think that caffeine and coffee aren't essentially, don't work as drugs, because they do. But they are generally safe. So hopefully we've clarified that. If anybody listened to one of our podcasts and was like, and now I will drink gallons of coffee because it is natural, we're very sorry, and we think you should scale back a little bit.
Mm-hmm. See, we're all about the integrity here on Balanced Breakfast.
Hopefully
so.
I did that justice. But yes. And also, it should be important to know that botulism toxin and cyanide are both naturally occurring, and you should not imbibe them. Okay.
There you go.
I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Nice PSA. That might take care of our PSA for the week.
Yeah.
All right. So now we're going to switch gears. We'll be back to the science a little bit later. A couple more studies that Catherine found. So now we're going to talk about the Tufts Student Showcase, which takes place on Friday, April 1st. It'll be the same day as the Friedman Open House for prospective students. So Curtis, why don't you... tell us all about it, because this is a change, actually, we should say. It used to be the Student Research Conference.
Yeah, that's right.
And now it's changing format this year. So do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Thanks, guys. Thanks again for having me on the show. Yeah, so last year we had the Student Research Conference, which is kind of a staple at Friedman, and it was a great success. It was awesome. I don't know if you guys were there, but it was a good time. And we had a lot of enthusiasm in our current class of second years to move forward with the next year's iteration of the conference, but we didn't have a whole lot of sort of support from the first years, so it didn't make a lot of sense to keep pushing the same sort of format with the Student Research Conference with no sort of leadership to take over.
Oh, okay.
After this year, so I guess just in collaboration with the Office of Student Affairs, they suggested that we sort of try to do something to mesh with the open house, because normally the Student Research Conference is the day after the open mm-hmm. house, and so it can be hard to sort of keep prospective students here just an extra day when you
right.
know, they've got lives elsewhere. And so this year is going to be a really great sort of new approach to the research conference. We've got like an hour or two slot right as the open house finishes. We got a little reception, some food, drinks, that kind of thing. And we'll have about 18 or 19 posters set up.
Mm-hmm.
All current students, dental students, public health students, Friedman students, presenting their work that they've done either for classes or for research, directed studies, you name it. And so it'll be a great chance to actually show prospective students what kind of work people do here and get them, you know, use the posters as kind of like an icebreaker, as opposed to what we were told in the past happens at Open House, which is just like prospective students sort of begin forming their own little cohort
right.
and existing current students kind of just keep being their own cohort. And
right.
it's hard to get them to interact. So
okay.
So yeah, this year we're changing things up, and I'm sure it'll be a fun event.
Awesome. And that's good, because that open house can be a long day, and then
yeah.
having to make it back in the next day for the research conference, yeah, it's rough. So
yeah.
this should be good logistically. So
yeah.
is that poster conference, because that's existed before, so is that going to be a similar format where they're going to be set up in a room and people can go through, or is it going to be
Yeah, different? Pretty much, okay. yeah.
Is this something where, is this all only Tufts students that are invited, or who's allowed to come and see the presentations?
So yeah, you know, in the past, the Student Research Conference was open to invitation for any students or faculty from any school. It was like a, you know, proper conference. This mm-hmm. one is more of a Tufts sort of exclusive event. Yeah.
Okay.
Really just because it is geared towards Friedman Open House,
mm-hmm.
towards prospective students. So I'm sure you could bring a guest if you wanted
right.
to. But it's really geared more towards Friedman
students. But if you were, say you were looking into going to nutrition school, like I know a lot of people who are like, oh, maybe I'll go back to school for nutrition, but you haven't already applied to the Friedman School, this might be a good time to come in and check it out.
That's a great point, yeah. It would be a great time to come check things out and mm-hmm. see, you know, meet the people that you could potentially be in school with and see what kind of things they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get an idea of what nutrition school is like.
Yeah, and having all facets. Because
people don't really know.
Yeah.
No one knows.
yeah.
yeah, it's tricky. Yeah, how many questions? Like, what are you majoring in? Oh, I'm getting a master's in science. Oh, so you're going to be a dietitian? No.
Yeah. So. Someone told me, I said, like, oh, I'm studying biochemical nutrition. And they said, okay, I have a couple questions. One, cannibalism. And I was like, interestingly, not what I study. I wish... I wish this was covered.
That should be the next
show. Oh my gosh, that should be the next show. Oh my goodness.
I'm a nutritional expert in cannibalism. I was like, And then he was like, can you eat by only looking at the sun? I'm like, okay, I can answer this question.
This person sounds awesome. Who are they?
He was great. He was great.
One thing I wanted to ask too about the conference is because you did before, when because the presenters were also from, could be from anywhere. So you did have some like pretty interesting and out there topics. And, you know, it was cool to see, I think on the one hand, like some really great research going on, but the, on the flip side, like you say, if like you're coming to Friedman, it might not necessarily be something that you would get into or might interest you. So in terms of the presentations so far, do you kind of have a general idea about how many there's going to be and what the different topics are going to be at this point?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for asking. I think that you're right. You know, in the normal conference, it was like a pretty big mix of things somewhat related to nutrition, but otherwise could be from anywhere and anything. This year, definitely focused on nutrition. We have a couple that are more public health oriented things, so not about nutrition per se, but definitely to do with health. We have just under 20 posters, at least, lined up to present. So hopefully everyone gets their posters in, and we're printing them for everybody. So there's definitely an incentive to just go ahead and do it. So since it is all exclusively Tufts students who are presenting, yeah, definitely you can imagine yourself doing these kinds of things because they're happening either in Jaharis or the building next to it. So it's kind of a nice, intimate view of how things work.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And so it's mainly been put together by you and Claire, correct? And then do you have a committee working on it too?
Yeah. We have a whole bunch of, there's about 7 or 8 of us who've been consistently working on this since last fall. So we're all pretty excited, gearing up, you know, coming up really soon. So
yeah, that'll be great. I know one of our, or Allie and Diana are presenting, so I heard all about that. Yeah, awesome. So that's exciting.
Are you allowed to share what their topic
they
is?
They did a study on, in like an epidemiological kind of survey on I honestly don't know the details of it, but heart health and some, I'm assuming, dietary interaction and heart health outcomes, which is neat because I think that, you know, something that a lot of students do at Friedman, at the public health school, and even maybe in Sackler, but I think people don't really realize how much of nutrition is statistics and how much of nutrition is epidemiology. And so how, if you are going to come to a nutrition school, that's going to be like a major focus of what you do. And I know, you know, most people who do public health or who do nutrition epidemiology, I mean, you have to do at least one of these big projects where you're looking at a large public data set and then running regressions and kind of trying to, you know, looking at associations between things. So that'll at least be at one poster that'll be super representative of what you do at Tufts and kind of get to see what you'll get to learn. So that'll be neat.
Mm-hmm. And it's cool because there's not a lot of opportunities, especially if you have a more formal conference necessarily. You might do a project for class or whatever, but you may not feel comfortable or think it's big enough, you know, to present. So this kind of gives a great opportunity to do that. And you mentioned the Office of Student Affairs. So what type of support have you gotten from the school for this too?
Oh, they've been great. You know, they've been really excited about things from the start and especially eager to sort of mesh with the open house. I think it really provides a nice cap on like you said, a long day. So they've just been really helpful with brainstorming, you know, ways to make it fun and interesting and helping sort of just communicate the event to the whole sort of Tufts community. And so they've been really, really helpful with about every step of the way.
Awesome. And so this is it's going to be all the student presentations kind of informal, so there's no panel or keynote like there has been in the past for the research conference?
Yeah, we toyed with the idea of doing that, but I think just given the setup of the space and the nature of the event, it just didn't really make sense. We had put out a call for people who wanted to give talks as well as poster presentations, but we're just going to keep it to poster and keep it more conversational. I think it'll work well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. And so is this going to be all in Jaharis?
It's actually in Sackler in 114, that like double room that opens up. So nice space, yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
Nice. So yeah, did you anything else you wanted to bring up about the conference or any other plugs?
I think you made a great point, Catherine, about you know, nutrition school being more about statistics. I think that, you know, if I was to show up as a prospective student and see these posters, I would think, oh my gosh, I'm not a math major. I don't know what's going on.
Right.
But you know, after a year, even at Friedman, you acquire those skills.
Oh, you will learn it. It won't, yeah. I don't know. I don't want to say I don't know any math, but I'm not a math person at all. But statistics and math are different.
Certainly, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely different. But I didn't know anything. I'd never even taken statistics before I came to Friedman.
Yeah.
And now that's pretty much what I do in almost every class and with everything I do outside of class. So.
Yeah. You come to school and I was like, oh, biochemical nutrition, I'll take mostly biochem. No, I've taken mostly statistics.
Right, you're right.
But, you know, some biochem. Enough biochem for it to be fun.
Can it be?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. That's where it's at.
So to recap, the Tufts Student Showcase will be on Friday, April 1st. And Sackler at Friedman, and so it's free for all Tufts students as well as incoming and prospective students. And there will be a reception. And do you know what time it kicks off? It had been TBD on the website. So
yeah,
it's been updated.
I think it's 3 or 3:30, but there'll be an announcement coming out this week just to firm that up. I think it kind of depends on when the last event in the open house day sort of finishes. So yeah, I think around 3:30.
All right, great. Excellent. So definitely check it out if you're around. And then want to touch, so this is not the only sort of Tufts student presentation that you do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
you're
also started up Nutrition. That's Nutrition.
Nutrition.
Mm-hmm. And so yeah, can you tell us about what that is and how that came about?
So funny enough, that's actually very closely tied to the student research conference.
Oh, okay.
Because last year we were at the sort of post-conference reception. And me and Kenny Westerman were talking about how awesome that experience was and how great it is to hear from students giving talks because there's just sort of a different level of communication between students, I think, even when they're giving a presentation and trying to be as formal as possible. So we really liked that and thought that Friedman could sort of benefit from having more opportunities for students to give presentations to fellow students.
Mm-hmm.
So we came up with the cheesiest title possible and decided that we'd sort of see if we could throw something together and just do a one-off event, kind of like a TED style talk where everyone talks for 5 to 10 minutes. You can use slides if you want, but you don't need to. And the first one went really well. We had, you know, a nice like crowd of like, I don't know, 20 people or so, and that inspired us to keep going with it. So now we've had 5, and we try to keep a nice balance between faculty and students. We've mixed in some industry representatives. We even had a Friedman staff there as well giving a talk. So we try to mix it up, try to keep a nice balance of science and policy, cover different topics. And the best part about it actually is that you don't, unlike your conventional academic talk where you talk about your research and your statistics that you've been doing for the last, I don't know how many months, in nutrition, you can talk about anything you want. So it can be the reason you came to nutrition school in the first place. Mm-hmm. It can be the latest study you read that you thought was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a side hobby that's only loosely related to nutrition or health. So it allows for a nice diversity of topics and really gives students a chance to practice their presentation skills and be really sort of concise with delivering a lot of information.
And do you guys have any more events coming up this year?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Okay, we've got one more this year on April 14th during the lunch hour from 12:15 to 1:15 in Jaharis, 118. And our lineup is still being worked out, but it's sure to be a memorable event.
Great.
Definitely. There's been some really cool topics, like you said, because it's not only students. I know Somali presented about kind of being on the staff and Parks presentation, which I haven't been able to make it to any of them live, but I have listened to a bunch kind of after they've been recorded and put online. And
so they all get recorded, so people who are interested can listen to the previous ones.
You can
ones.
Go back and listen. And Park presented on
Park Wild.
Yep. Thank you for the clarification. But sort of...
At US Food Policy, right?
You can check him on Twitter, yes. Yeah. That is his Twitter account. And he did a thing where academics, right, are kind of working to reduce their own carbon footprint with travel and stuff like that. So you get topics from all over the spectrum about nutrition, sustainability, that sort of thing.
Yeah, his topic was really interesting, just about, you know, how much academics fly to conferences and that kind of thing. So Park hasn't flown in years.
Really?
He hasn't been in a plane in years.
Really? So does how does he attend conferences? He Skype in? Or how did he get to the White House when he was at the White House a few weeks ago?
I don't know what he does.
Trains.
Yeah. He rents a car and drives or something. I don't know. But he with the exception of seeing his parents, he had them fly up to see him. He hasn't flown, like I said, in maybe 3, 4, 5 years.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, really sticking to his word. So
yeah,
kudos to Park and everything he's doing.
Yeah. So and check out the next nutrition event. That's April 14th for more similar topics. That's my birthday.
Yeah.
And
nice.
So. And
this is for Matt's birthday. this entire event. Mm-hmm.
It's going to be just me talking.
There'll be a presentation about Matt's entire biography.
About the first day of his life.
That would be a really solid nutrition idea, just a biography of one of the students.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. I'm going to work on this now.
Okay.
Let's see. So, yeah, check out nutrition. And if people want to get involved or have any questions, they should contact you.
Yeah, definitely. Reach out to Kenny or I. We're hoping to try to keep this going, even though Kenny and I are both graduating from the master's program. We're hoping to sort of keep it going somehow. So don't be discouraged if you don't make it out on this last one. There will be other opportunities. Just email us and let us know that you're interested.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that. So we're going to take a quick music break, and then we will be back to talk about... this Politico came up with their big feature kind of thing is called The Agenda, and they have one in nutrition, which they've come out with some interesting content there to dive into. Also, maybe some follow-up talk about the food movement, which has been a very hot topic in the past week or so. And, of course, some more science and studies, and then a quiz about... who's planted what at the White House over the years. So stay tuned for all of that.
But for now, enjoy Vegetables by the Beach Boys.
Fortunately, you don't have to do that. This is going to be... why don't you introduce the actual song that you picked?
Okay, this song is Satellites by The Gray Season. They are a local band. We saw them at Boston Calling. We thought they were great. We saw them again and realized, they are at least 7 years younger than I am. But they have a show coming up in Alston on April 8th, I think, and they're great. And
April tickets 6th, are
April 6th. Thank you, at the Great Scott, and they're great. And so tickets are cheap. You should go. I think they're great.
Then they play the next day in Germany. That's interesting. All right. So again, this is Satellites by Gray Season off the album Time Will Tell You Well on an Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. If you want to call in, number here is 617-627-3800.
We Let's go inside the mind of a 10-year-old.
I should have worn those earrings today. I like those earrings. Gabby has those awesome earrings. I need to ask her where she got those, but that's just what she would want me to do. I'll have Michaela ask her for me.
Buckle up, Sarah.
Yeah, but then Michaela will be like, why don't you just ask her yourself? That's just like Michaela.
Sarah, buckle up.
Michaela's such a great name. I wish I was called Michaela. There's like a dozen Sarahs in my class.
Hey, we're not hitting the road until you buckle up, honey.
Oh yeah, seatbelt. I forget sometimes because my brain is like busy, you know? I wonder if there's pizza at school today.
Sometimes it can be tough to get through to your kids, but it's not impossible. Always make sure they're wearing their seatbelts, even on short drives. Remember, you have the keys, you have the power. Never give up until they buckle up. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council. Visit safercar.gov/kidsbuckleup for more information.
And welcome back to an Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. You just heard the song Satellite from Gray Season. Again, you can see those guys April 6th over at Great Scott in Alston. And that was Catherine's pick of the week. Mm-hmm. And she also tried something else out this week, right?
I did. I tried something new. I'm going to be writing a review about it. But I tried a new food startup delivery service. It's not Blue Apron. It is called Hungry Root. And so basically what this company is they have, everybody's heard of spiralized vegetables, right? Spiralized vegetables?
No, I haven't heard.
Okay, so basically there's this thing that's become really trendy where it's a spiralizer and you can put basically any vegetable through it and it turns it into noodles. So you can create any type of noodle dish you want but with vegetables
instead of
pasta. Like
a zucchini noodle, right?
You put like a zucchini noodles, like the one you think of. But this one has really interesting ones because they have like sweet potato noodles, carrot noodles, turnip noodles. Really neat. They send you this noodle dish with like the sauces and the protein. And basically the point of it is that it's like a really healthy meal, a good way to get a ton of your vitamins because it's from fresh vegetables. And it takes about 7 minutes to make. So I think a lot of the thing that we talk about when we mention, oh, we need to increase access to produce, we need to increase access to healthy fresh vegetables is that then you also need to increase access to like time to prepare those vegetables and, you know, cooking and all of these skills that a lot of people and maybe millennials don't really have a lot of. And so this kind of takes away all that because all you need to do is throw everything in a pan and in about 5 minutes it's done. It's really tasty. So I ordered a bunch of these because I had a coupon and I was like, oh, I'll try this out. And I think they are delicious and amazing. There was one that was like carrot noodles and it had peanut sauce on it with sriracha and it was so good. Mm. And then I had one that was like Italian style and I just think it was really great. But I think there are a couple kind of caveats, right? And one is that it's not super cheap. So you're definitely paying for the convenience.
How much does it run?
It's about $8-$9 a meal. And then if you
questions about this meal, but you can
if
continue.
You add something like protein to it, it costs a little bit more. So I mean my future self, if I order these, I think I would make a bunch of chicken at home and then, you know, cut it up and put it on top rather than ordering it with the protein. But there's that. And then the other problem is, of course, I think this is also a big issue with Blue Apron as well, is the packaging. So instead of buying produce, you're putting it all in a produce bag, coming home, and there's not a lot of waste. I mean, this is coming in a box. It's packed in a refrigerator pack. And so the question is, you know, how, you know, you're probably making a healthier choice for yourself if you're in a situation where you're not going to have time to cook a meal, but are you really making a better choice from a sustainability standpoint? You know, so I don't know. I think I would open that to discussion. If you see, you can pull up their website. It's these men
nice,
slurping noodles.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, definitely describe it for the listeners.
Yes. Oh, I'll describe this for you. So there's some beautiful photos of the packaging. Amazing packaging, though. Like, I will say that, like, just, you know, it's not sustainable, but it's super well designed. and then you have two men just slurping some bowls of noodles. And then you have a bunch of the different products that they sell. And they're all, I know this is not what Matt likes, but they're all calorie and portion controlled. So they're all about 500 calories.
Yeah, see, we'll
good
get back
for
to that.
Someone like me where my meals should be about 500 calories. And so, like, boom, done. And maybe not so good for someone who is a man or B, I mean, because it's pretty, I mean, unless you're much shorter, it's pretty low calorie. Or, you know, if you're exercising a great deal or something, it might not be quite enough for a meal.
That's like a couple weeks ago when we were prepping for the show, we went to a restaurant and I decided, you know, go the healthy route and get a nice little quinoa bowl. And, so
those bowls are not low calorie.
it kind of is. Well, yeah. Okay. So there's two things to go. First of all, this is what I was talking about. This is, to me, what becomes a product of the quote food movement. And to recap for Kurt, yeah, this is great imagery. Does not make me want to eat those noodles. There's a guy like what has sauce all over himself.
Beets. I think it's beets.
Oh, he's a good looking guy though. I don't know what the problem is.
So and he, yeah,
and they're men and they're eating.
He's probably a millennial.
Those are reasonably sized men eating 500
calorie
meals.
Yeah, they're definitely
meals.
Eating.
That's, okay. So to recap for Curtis real quick.
I don't want to generalize and say that men shouldn't be eating 500 calorie meals. Some eat as many or as few calories as you want per meal.
Yes, but okay. So two things. First of all, this is a product of the food movement that we discussed last week, I would argue. So Curtis, you missed it. We discussed a column that's been posted about millennials faking the food movement, and you know, people like to make these startup companies like this and take Instagram photos of their food and post it online. And the kind of question was, are you really making a difference? Like, why aren't people doing this about sustainability or workers' rights and things like that? And like all the stuff that Eric Schlosser and Mark Bittman and Michael Pollan and Mary Nestle started, like, what are millennials doing with this knowledge? Are they actually improving things, or are they all sequestered in Austin and San Francisco and Boston and Brooklyn with their noodle bowls and quinoa and things like that? So we've had a lot of controversial discussion over that. So, and this is kind of one of my beefs with the food movement is things like this. And then also you get into talking about, I mean, it is granted, it's healthy food, it's good. But when you're talking about food access and costs and things like that, like Catherine was just talking about, for someone like me, going back to the quinoa bowl I had, it's like I'm starving a half hour later because it's not enough food. And it's like, if I want to, use this for my sustenance, I'm going to have to probably have at least two bowls or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's right there. That's almost $20, right? So it's like not helping me.
Well, I think, okay, let me say a little bit about, here's what their sort of message is. You know, they want it to be convenient food, they want it to be fresh food, and they want it to be, they say, guiltless. And I take issue with the idea of feeling guilty about eating food, because I think that, you know, but that's a product of the culture, and I don't think Hungry Root has come up with the idea of guilt versus guiltless for foods. And it's, you know, it's gluten-free because it's made of vegetables. But they say, we want to change how America eats. We believe nature's most nutritious food group, vegetables, deserves to be recognized for more than its nutritional value, and we think when it's prepared correctly, I'm paraphrasing, they're very satisfying and indulgent, which I agree, because this food was really good. And they basically say only 6% of Americans eat the recommended amount of vegetables, and 74% of Americans are overweight, and so why don't we create these high vegetable, lower portion size foods that are very convenient? Because if you think about convenience foods, you think of really calorically dense, usually, you know, stable, shelf-stable packaged foods and sandwiches.
But is this changing the way America eats, or is it changing the way a select subset of people are already thinking about this?
Right,
eats?
That's like, a good question.
You know, that's kind of my thing.
I don't know. I think that's a good question. I think, though, in order for it to become an affordable option for lots of people, it has to start, and then they can narrow the kind of their margins, or not even narrow their margins, but streamline the process and reduce the cost of producing those foods. But yeah, who knows? Is this a niche market? Is this something where it's like, well, really only hipster millennials with, you know, a certain amount of disposable income are ever going to be interested in this? And it's not going to reach other people. And I don't think that I know that answer, but I think that it's necessarily a bad thing, if that makes sense. And I think, too, you have to think about what the food movement is, because we were having this discussion actually yesterday. And I think the half of the food movement is sustainability and social justice and workers' rights. And that's a really important aspect of the food movement. The other half of the food movement is health and chronic disease and obesity. And I think that the problem is that because the idea of the food movement is so large and ambiguous, you know, one thing can, so many things can self-identify as being part of the food movement, So I would say that something like this that utilizes the sort of capitalist system that we already have and sort of seeks to find a market, a way that's valuable within the market that system that we currently have to get people to eat more vegetables, like I would say that is part of a food movement. But the question is how you define, right, like what the food movement is. And I know like my personal interest is in obesity and chronic disease and weight loss. So, of course, I find that to be very compelling. But if you're coming from a different angle, you could be like, well, this is total nonsense. This isn't what we should be focusing on.
Which tends to be my angle.
Right, yeah.
So, Curtis, if you want to, feel free to jump in at any time, too. I know that we got heated about this, but if you have...
I'm just curious if you're thinking, Catherine, about, you know, using this as a way to get people to start eating vegetables in a way that they never have before. Mm. And if you think that maybe, like Matt said, you know, after quinoa bowl, like half an hour or an hour later, he's hungry again because of the low calories and because it's just not as filling as other meals.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that might sort of, pardon the pun, but like leave a bad taste in people's mouth after they've given this a try and they're like, wow, vegetables are expensive and they don't fill me up?
Yeah. I don't know. That's a really good question. I was wondering, like, would there be a way to do a version of this company that, and Hungry Root guys, like if you're interested, maybe, see what you think, but of doing something that was like including those vegetables, but then including a grain that's a little bit less expensive. So adding like a brown rice and then adding like beans, something that's already sort of inexpensive, mm-hmm. and creating a slightly more high calorie meal that's going to meet everybody's needs. And making that a cheaper because you are using less expensive ingredients, and also keeping that vegetable level high, because mm-hmm. because I was like, well, what would be really great is if you could find a way to do this that would be convenient enough where the person who needs to go to McDonald's, or the person who needs to go to a fast food or convenience store to get their meal can do this instead, and it's in that same price range, but you're still getting all the health benefits. But I definitely think for most people, I know that I saw one person who was like, wait, this is just spiralized carrots. Like I can do this at home, but yeah. That's not the target person. That person already has a way to spiralize carrots.
And they grow their carrots in their backyard.
Yeah, they probably grow their carrots in their backyard.
So you can't touch that person.
But yeah, I definitely have wondered about that. Like what would be the way to make this really scalable? I'm sure it's already scalable, to people with disposable income on diets, but how to make it scalable so that it's actually a realistic idea for everyone. And I think that also comes down to the packaging and like how do you work with packaging. Mm-hmm. I don't know a lot about that.
Yeah, it's tough. And one of the things we discussed a little bit yesterday was with anything, food movement or not, is where do you kind of draw the line? Where do you make that compromise? Because it is true, like if you're able to eat conveniently and healthy, but you have this question of packaging, you know, I just feel like a lot of stuff in today's discourse will kind of get discounted because of one thing. So like a lot of people may think this concept is great, but if you're not sustainably packaging it, then they're like, nope, it's not, you know, throw it out. Nope, not gonna use it.
Like, but nothing. Yeah, but nothing's like that.
Exactly.
Right? It's like we want it all. We want it to be, you know, environmentally sensitive. We want it to be healthy. We want it to be to fill you up. We want it to be, you know, all these things. It's not going to be all these things.
Yeah, which I think goes kind of on the flip side of my argument with the food movement is, even though I think you should be fighting for those things, they're not going to happen overnight. Which,
right.
A little bit of a segue here into the Marion Nestle's piece on that Politico feature.
So Marion Nestle wrote a piece on the Farm,
Bill about how, and I definitely have some issues with a lot of stuff she says about attempting to teach the Farm Bill. I mean, they teach the Farm Bill at Friedman. I'm not going to say it's easy, but it's certainly doable.
For a little context, she wrote, Politico just released an entire food issue.
Yep.
And Marion Nestle contributed something about teaching a class that was all about the Farm Bill and how the Farm Bill works. And I didn't learn about the Farm Bill. So you did learn about the Farm Bill. So she kind of throws it out there that like it's actually impossible to teach the Farm Bill because the Farm Bill doesn't make any sense. I'm summarizing, but
basically, I mean, yeah, that's what she's saying. How she called it like a mistake, I think, that she tried to teach it.
But all kinds of things that don't make sense are taught.
Yeah, like
systematically and routinely across the world.
There's a lot of things in her.
Doesn't mean you can't teach them.
Yeah, she
or at least talk about.
Well,
them.
I don't think
she
really
came across very well at the beginning of this piece. She does touch on some. She makes some good points later on.
Yeah, I really like this piece.
But so like here's one of the things where she I don't know. She's talking about how so for those who don't know, a big part of the Farm Bill is you have basically half of it is what everybody calls the subsidies, but it's kind of just the whole system in place for farmers and for agriculture and how you support that economically and grow the right things. And you, that could be an entire show or an entire semester to discuss. And then the other half of it is SNAP benefits. And basically they're both part of the farm bill, because the side that wants SNAP is constantly butting heads with the side that wants the supports for farmers and ranchers and all that. So, and neither one would probably get passed without the other. So that's why they're always combined. And she talks about that, and she just kind of, it's really hard to see, well, maybe it's not if you follow her pretty closely, but I couldn't really tell where she stands on restrictions for SNAP benefits, but she makes some allusions in this and some other pieces that she's written about. It sounds like SNAP should be restricted. But it kind of comes across as a contradiction, because then she's talking about all the other, I don't know. Great.
Where does she say SNAP should be restricted?
Well, that's the thing. She never comes out and says that,
but
the way she refers to it, it kind of, I infer that she's saying it should be restricted.
Mm-hmm.
And like she says, politics makes strange bedfellows, and both the food industry for reasons of profit and advocates for the poor for reasons of politics want to keep it that way. Perversely, SNAP can even provide an incentive to drink sodas. So she's kind of making, kind of wading into that argument that SNAP should be restricted. You shouldn't be able to buy soda and some other unhealthy foods. But at the same time, like, she's only kind of saying that SNAP should be restricted. She's making this connection to the Farm Bill, where there's a whole, I mean, SNAP advocates separately from the Farm Bill do not want them regulated for reasons about, you know, stigma and things like that. So
Right. She
kind of discounts that whole thing. And she also brings up what we talked about, where she talks about how the leading commentators on our food system, such as Michael Pollan, Mark Bittman, Ricardo Salvador, and Olivier Deschutes, I don't know how to say that name, have called on the president and Congress to create a national food policy, something we don't have but badly need. Later on, she says that there needs to be reform, but doesn't know exactly how does she put it. How to reform it is quite another matter.
Mm-hmm.
After saying that it should be reformed, and she never offers any solution, at least in this piece. And it kind of goes back to what we talked about last week of the Farm Bill. Like, you have all these people that got things started, mm-hmm. and now what?
Right. And I think, well, she also says this is the real reason I taught this class, in brackets, on the food movement, to encourage students, the future of American democracy, and future participants of the food movement to get political and advocate healthier and more sustainable food policies. So in my mind, I'm reading this article, and I think she's not trying to say this is messed up and here's the solution. She's trying to say, you know, we need to be more exposed to how all of this sort of comes together, and then that will empower people to be able to advocate for whatever it is that they feel about the food movement. But the question is the food movement real? Mm-hmm. So, because that's like the bigger question we've kind of been talking about for 2 weeks. And how does this all tie into, like, buying, you know, is it something that can be driven by the market? Is it something that can be driven by, like, a bunch of, you know, disruptive tech startups, you know, sending food to people?
Oh, yeah, disruption. That was that big word.
Disruption is like the word for some reason. Can it work that way? Does it need to be, there's a national food policy that basically from the top down legislates that this is how agriculture has to work, and agriculture needs to work in a way that then, you know, spills over into changing the way people eat? Or, you know, is it something that is entirely social justice and is completely divorced from food? Like, you know, to me, social justice does mean, you know, that SNAP dollars are not, they don't restrict you. I mean, I find that to be a little bit sort of punitive.
I agree, yeah.
And I think that it's short-sighted to think that making SNAP dollars restricted, like WIC.
See, I'm pro restriction.
What?
I'm pro restriction.
I don't see that as being a good thing. And WIC dollars are restricted. Mm-hmm. There are specific things you can buy with WIC, because the point of that is to ensure that you can buy and can afford and can feed your child foods that we know are going to lead to growth and health.
People made that comparison, and it's definitely valid that there's good points to be made there, but at the same time, it's a little bit of apples and oranges, because, like you just mentioned, it's specifically for a certain population at a certain time of their life. And then, real quick, because we're running a little bit out of time, but there's another piece on that feature from Politico. They had a Q&A with Tom Vilsack, the outgoing head of the USDA, or the Department of Agriculture, and there were a couple interesting comments on topics that we've touched on. One thing actually was with the Farm Bill, where they ask him, there's some pretty good questions that they ask him, and one of them is about reconciling with the USDA and the guidelines. And it's like, you know, you want to do this thing, provide these guidelines for Americans to be healthy, but it's also your job to advance the economic interests of farmers and ranchers and things like that. And he says, in terms specifically about the meat lobby, he says, I think we were pretty clear on the dietary guidelines that there are substitutes for red meat so that folks can look at multiple ways to get the protein they need, and that we want folks to think about a more balanced approach. That's perfectly sensible, perfectly reasonable, and that was in the dietary guidelines. So I know that you can kind of call that a little bit of a cop-out maybe, but I think it's interesting that he is reiterating the kind of sustainability thing.
What do you think, Curtis?
I don't think the guidelines read like that, though. So even if someone were to pick up the guidelines and read them, which I don't think anyone really does, except for, you know, academics and policymakers, us. I like the way he put it. It sounds reasonable and fair, but it also, I don't think it went into practice like that.
Yeah.
It's definitely, it's good that he calls it out here, but yeah, it can be lost in the if you just sit down and try to read the guidelines.
Right.
Yeah. One comment, going back to the compromise you were just talking about and how things don't work overnight. He talks about how people interpret the subsidies provided in the Farm Bill. So he says, those who have that approach, I don't think they understand fully what the USDA does. I hear people say, well, you only subsidize commodity crops. That fails to recognize the incredible support we're giving to fruits and vegetables, for example, in our school lunch program. So you can certainly make the argument that specialty crops like fruits and vegetables are not getting incredible support by the Farm Bill. But I don't know, it's kind of cool that he's promoting some of these things, but later on he mentions it's not the same USDA as it was 7 years ago. And to me, that's kind of like a microcosm of the whole Obama administration and like this whole expectation for immediate change that came about. And it's like, we didn't get that, but there are some good things too. And that includes the Farm Bill and the USDA.
Yeah. So I think that we've conclusively decided that the food movement is real. That's what I would say that all of this builds.
Matt's not happy about that.
I never said it was real. I said it was misguided.
That we were faking it. Well, Tamar Haspel has a really interesting post back in January in the Washington Post about how the food movement kind of leveled off at a certain. So if anybody's interested, definitely check out the Politico food issue and then Tamar Haspel's article from, it's somewhere in January, about the food.
And I'm sorry, I'm going to bring up GMOs one more time because he talks about them in this Q&A. But it goes back to the GMO labeling, which we've talked about. By the way, the Senate bill did not pass this week. It got shot down, although Republicans also voted against it in a way that they could bring it back up in the future. So that whole fight isn't over. But he kind of says the whole thing about you don't want to convey the wrong message with GMOs. And he says that there has not been a total understanding of why we label in this country. And there's primarily been two reasons: to provide consumers information about the nutritional value of the food they're consuming. The other is to warn people of a particular hazard associated with the product if you have a condition. And GMOs don't apply in either case. So he is saying that they're not hazardous, so that's not why you would label it. And he says the challenge is finding the delicate balance between giving consumers the information they want to know about their food while making sure it is not conveyed in a way that sends the wrong message. Although then he goes on to say he wants to avoid the so-called patchwork of laws that could be created by the states and that there should be one uniform labeling standard. So that's all about GMOs for the week. And if you want to check out, again, go check out the Politico.com/agenda and a whole bunch of interesting articles about food, the food system, stuff about chicken, stuff about Michelle Obama, all across the spectrum.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to play one last song and then come back, hopefully squeeze in some science and then do a nice little quiz. Next up for music is a brand new one from the Deftones. This is called Doomed User off their upcoming album Gore, and you're listening to An Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO 91.5 FM.
And that is the Deftones with Doomed User, the latest off their upcoming album, Gore. And you are listening. You can tell who picks what song each week.
Cannibalism.
This morning, Gore.
And so we're here again in studio with Curtis, who is helping or is putting together, along with Claire, the
And a bunch of others, too.
And a bunch of others, yeah. Give credit to the full committee.
Yeah.
But the Tough Student Showcase, which again is Friday, April 1st at Friedman. Free admission for all Tough students, as well as the prospective students who are going to be there at the open house. So definitely check that out. And go to the next nutrition event, NEW Nutrition, which is going to be April 14th, 12:15, I believe. Also at Jaharis.
Thank you.
So all sorts of stuff going on. And now we have time for a quick science minute from Catherine, and then another quiz.
So two kind of interesting studies were published this week that talked about children's health and intake. And they kind of, they're not opposed, but they kind of have different outlooks. And one was that school breakfast programs. One study monitored kids over a period of years, like 540 students, and kind of monitored who was eating breakfast at school and who wasn't. And they also were able to track who was eating breakfast at home. So they would find, you know, some kids were eating no breakfast. They were skipping breakfast at home, not eating breakfast at school. And some kids were eating two breakfasts. They were eating breakfast at home and then coming eating breakfast at school. And there was some concern that, well, these kids that aren't eating breakfast, that's not so good. But the kids that are eating two breakfasts, like, they might actually be in worse condition because they're eating more calories. But they found that that is not the case. The students who were eating one or two breakfasts over time were at more likely to be at a healthier weight, less likely to be overweight or obese than those who were eating breakfast at home and again at school. So people who ate breakfast twice were less likely to be overweight than kids who weren't eating breakfast at all. And so I think that it provided kind of an important framework for saying for not cutting school breakfasts and making sure that kids have access to those calories. Interestingly, they found that weight changes for people who ate two breakfasts were no different than for all other students. So all of these students, their weight changes were the same, but the likelihood to be overweight or obese was greater in people who weren't eating breakfast. And this is something that's kind of been found in studies about adults too. You look at people who are overweight and obese, people who eat breakfast are more likely to be at a healthy weight. We've all heard that, and that's kind of the reason for that recommendation. But actually, they don't really know why that is. You could be at a healthy weight and not eat breakfast. You could be at a healthy weight and eat breakfast. It just is like, it's just an observational trend. But it's important because it would hopefully be evidence to keep policy in place that would allow students to get breakfast at school.
Mm-hmm.
The other study is that children who are given foods that are highly calorically dense and given larger than portion sizes than what they need, eat more food. And it sounds kind of silly. Like, of course, when you give people more calorically dense food, they eat more. But there's a lot of this idea that children naturally regulate what they're eating. And if you ever had younger siblings or if you have kids or if you babysit a lot, you'll see like kids will pick something up and eat like two bites of it and then be like ready to play again. Whereas you're like, every time I sit down to eat, it's like this whole experience. Like, why are you so done eating? And so there's this idea that, like, oh, kids regulate, they eat what they need. But no, like, you can fool children's stomachs just as well as adults. If you make food really calorically dense, if you give them too big a portion size, they will eat more. So that's good reasoning to kind of adjust your recipes or adjust the food products that you're feeding your kids and making sure that they're not too calorically dense so that your children eat according to their hunger and not accidentally overeat.
Nice. But yeah, so good.
Those are the two
parenting tips there. Yeah.
And yeah.
School lunch and breakfast, very important.
Yeah.
Don't let them get cut. All right. So now we're going to end things up real quick with a quiz about what presidents have grown at the White House over the years. This is also part of that Politico piece. Again, it's politico.com/agenda. So first, in 1835, this president had a hot greenhouse built at the White House.
See now.
And it was known as the Orangery. The Orangery. It was made of glass and was heated to allow tropical fruit trees and flowers to grow despite the harsh northern climate. And about 20 years later, it was destroyed and replaced by a full-scale greenhouse.
So now I'm going to be embarrassed because I don't know who was president in 1835.
This president was not very friendly to the Native Americans.
Oh, Andrew Jackson.
Andrew Jackson, yes.
So what was your guess?
I guess 1835 and not friendly to Native Americans didn't really narrow it down for me. So
Curtis is a disadvantage on this quiz.
Oh,
I forgot when we started.
He's
Canadian.
Canadian. which is good. It's not a bad thing, but it means you don't know as much about presidents.
Glad to hear it's not a bad thing.
I don't know. It's not a bad thing. I mean, Justin Bieber, his new album was great.
Ooh, let's not go there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we'll say that.
Trudeau.
All right, so this was... let's give too much away. So this president ordered the first planting of a vegetable garden on the White House grounds. However, before it could, before he could enjoy the harvest, he lost the election and was replaced.
I thought you were going to say he died in a bathtub, and I was going to be like, I can, let's see.
First president to live at the White House, to occupy the White House, which is a little bit of a trick hint.
Oh gosh, he lost the election. I don't know.
John Adams.
I wouldn't. Oh, yeah, he did lose an election. I did know that.
It lost to Jefferson. All right. This president established the first Victory Garden. It was across from the White House during, I can't tell you what event.
Would have been World War II.
To support food production at home. In year blank, he brought in sheep to mow and fertilize the White House lawn.
Oh, my gosh. This is going to be so embarrassing for me. Is it Eisenhower?
See, it was.
Is it?
Not World War II, it was World War
One. World War One. Oh, okay.
Woodrow Wilson. Okay. So there you go. He had a...
Sounds like a hipster.
I was just going to say, there was very sustainable
Victory
farming
gardens
methods.
Are, like, coming back. You can get... You can plant... Victory Garden, I think, is a brand or something.
And they were part of World War II as well.
Yeah.
So, real quick, last one. This president, who ironically had been a farmer, did not plant a vegetable garden at the White House. Instead, he installed solar panels.
I know who this is.
He was a farmer. Come on.
The peanut farmer.
Yeah.
Jimmy Carter.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. So that wraps up. If you want to take the rest of the quiz, or for